He was also awarded the Black Badge for the Wounded and the Medal for the Care of the German People. Toward the end of 1942, Mengele was posted back to the Race and Resettlement Office, this time at its headquarters in Berlin. The fact that Mengele worked under the aegis of the SS and the Police Doctor's Office, which had a medical supervisory role in the extermination camps, suggests that he was entrusted with the secret of the final solution at quite an early stage. Although Hitler had decided in the summer of 1941 to press ahead with the final solution, the decision to adopt it as official policy had been taken only the past January by 15 high-ranking bureaucrats before sitting down to lunch in a secret conclave in the Berlin suburb of Wannsee. It is possible that as a result of discovering the vast amount of human material available for experiments at Auschwitz, Mengele, once in Berlin, did all he could to secure a posting there. It seems equally likely that he sought this job in collaboration with his former tutor, Professor von Verschuer, whose guiding hand was certainly behind his transfer from the Russian front to Berlin. By the summer of 1942, von Verschuer was director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, overseeing research programs into racial purity. In June 1942, while Mengele was still serving with the Viking Division at the Russian front, von Verschuer told a colleague that he planned to take with me my co-workers, initially Schader and Graeber, later Mengele and Frommer. In January 1943, von Verschuer wrote to another colleague that my assistant Mengele has been transferred to a post in Berlin so that in his free time he can work at the Institute. Dr. Benno Müller-Hill of Cologne University, who has had access to von Verschuer's private papers, is in little doubt that von Verschuer finally persuaded Mengele to take this next, and for him, disastrous, step in his life. I would almost bet it was von Verschuer who talked him into going to Auschwitz, Müller-Hill said. He would have said, there's a big opportunity for science there, many races there, many people. Why don't you go? It's in the interest of science. After Mengele's transfer to Berlin, he was promoted to the rank of Hauptsturmführer, captain. In May 1943, the posting came. By the end of the month, he arrived at a vast barbed wire enclosure in a swampy valley an hour out of Krakow in southern Poland. This was Auschwitz, or to the Germans who love to abbreviate everything, the KZ, shorthand for Konzentrationslager, or concentration camp. Chapter 2. Auschwitz, May 1943 to January 1945. The sight that greeted Josef Mengele when his train drew near to Auschwitz was awesome. One landmark especially must have caught his eye, as it did for a fellow doctor, Miklos Nisli, when he first arrived. An immense square chimney built of red bricks, tapering towards the summit. I was especially struck by the enormous tongues of flame rising between the lightning rods. I tried to realize what hellish cooking would require such a tremendous fire. A faint wind brought the smoke towards me. My nose, then my throat, were filled with the nauseating odor of burning flesh and scorched hair. In high summer, the sun scorched the earth, and the stagnant, heavy, breezeless air pervaded every corner of the camp with its stench of burning flesh. In winter, Auschwitz was ravaged by ice storms sweeping in off the Vistula River. Most Poles considered this remote corner of their country too inhospitable to live in. Himmler considered it the perfect place for the largest extermination center in the Third Reich's genocide program, as its commandant, Rudolf Höss, guessed after the Reichsfuhrer's visit in March 1941, when he ordered a vast new expansion program. The numbers envisaged were, at this time, something entirely new in the history of concentration camps. At that time, a camp containing 10,000 persons was considered exceptionally large. The insistence of the Reichsfuhrer SS that the construction work must be pushed on, regardless of all present or future difficulties, many of which were and would be well nigh insuperable, gave me much food for thought even then. By the time Mengele arrived in May 1943, Auschwitz was packed with almost 140,000 prisoners and stretched for miles in all directions. Dr. Niesli, a Hungarian Jew who served as an inmate pathologist under Mengele's supervision, was overwhelmed when he discovered how large the camp was. I returned to Barracks 12 just in time for Dr. Mengele's arrival. He drove up and sent for me and asked me to join him in his car, and we started off again along the bumpy road. For about 12 minutes, we drove through the labyrinth of barbed wire and entered well-guarded gates, thus passing from one section to another. Only then did I realize how vast the KZ was. Few people had the possibility of verifying that, because the majority died at the very place to which they were sent when they first arrived. Later, I learned that Auschwitz KZ had, at certain periods, held more than 100,000 people within its enclosure of electrified barbed wire. This enormous camp, surrounded by barbed wire and patrolled by SS guard dogs, contained 5 crematoria and gas chambers. On a clear day, flame and black smoke could be seen for 30 miles, spewing from the chimneys of the crematoria that broke the flat marshland skyline around Auschwitz. According to Commandant Hirsch, the highest total of Jews gassed in 24 hours was 9,000. This figure was attained in the summer of 1944 during the action against Hungary, using all the installations except number 3. On that day, owing to delays on the line, 5 trains arrived instead of 3 as expected, and, in addition, the carriages were more crowded than usual. Although, as Hirsch said, Himmler ordered records to be burned after every large action, the total number of Jews gassed at Auschwitz is now known to be between 1.1 and 1.3 million. According to Hirsch, a figure of 2.5 million was supplied to him by Adolf Eichmann shortly before Berlin was surrounded. Eichmann and his permanent deputy, Gunther, were the only ones who possessed the necessary information on which to calculate the total numbers destroyed. Mass extermination, then, was the primary purpose of Auschwitz, but it was by no means its only important function. Auschwitz was also a slave labor camp, providing a pool of workers for German companies contributing to the war effort. The strongest of the new prisoners were selected to live solely because they could be made to work until they dropped dead. Those who collapsed were sometimes kicked and beaten to determine if they were still alive. 34 companies, many of them still household names today, like Krupp, AEG Telefunken, Siemens, Bayer, and IG Farben, made fortunes from the tortured labor of Jews, Russians, Poles, some Allied prisoners of war, and German prisoners of conscience. The biggest IG Farben factory was at Monowitz, a subcamp in Auschwitz that made synthetic rubber. In return for providing slave labor, Farben paid the SS a daily rate of 4 Reichsmarks for a skilled laborer, 3 Reichsmarks for an unskilled laborer, and 1.5 Reichsmarks for a child. In his evidence against Farben directors in the post-war trials against German industrialists, Benjamin B. Ferenc, an American lawyer, told the court that Farben crowded 400 prisoners into a block intended for 162. Each wooden bunk, padded only with a thin layer of filthy straw, was shared by three prisoners. Dysentery and diarrhea added to their misery. Inmates were literally being worked to death. They were forced to run while unloading heavy cement bags weighing more than 100 pounds. Drinking water was contaminated, clothing was sparse, and the food was totally inadequate. Many died of freezing or starvation. The conditions for all forced laborers were terrible, but by far the worst were the conditions of the Jews. In sharp contrast to the squalid conditions for inmates, life for the SS non-commissioned ranks who guarded the camp, participating in the gassings euphemistically known as special actions, executions, and the rounding up of slave labor, was tolerably comfortable. Any special action work attracted extra rations, 10 cigarettes a day, 1/5 of a liter of vodka, and 4 ounces of German sausage. But for SS officers like Mengele, the rewards were even more generous. One of Mengele's Auschwitz colleagues, Dr. Johann Kramer, kept a diary. While he devoted only a few sentences to his role in the special actions, he recalled in detail how he savored the good life, especially the food served up by chefs at the Waffen-SS Club. 5 September days were particularly memorable. September 6th. Today, an excellent Sunday dinner. Tomato soup, 1/2 of chicken with potatoes and red cabbage, and magnificent vanilla ice cream. In the evening at 8 o'clock, attended another special action outdoors. September 9th. This morning, I received most welcome news from my lawyer that I was divorced from my wife from the 1st of the month. Later, was present as the physician at the flogging of 8 camp inmates and at 1 execution by shooting with a small caliber gun. Got soap flakes and 2 cakes of soap. September 17th. Have ordered a casual coat from Berlin. September 20th. This Sunday afternoon, I listened from 3 p.m. till 6 p.m. to a concert of the prisoners' band in glorious sunshine. The bandmaster was a conductor of the state opera in Warsaw. 80 musicians. Roast pork for dinner. September 23rd. This night was present at the 6th and 7th special actions. At 8 o'clock in the evening, supper in the home of Gruppenführer Pohl, a truly festive meal. We had baked pike, as much as we wanted, real coffee, excellent beer, and sandwiches. Other trappings of a comfortable life were preserved by Camp Commandant Hirsch, who lived with his wife and 5 children in a white stucco house surrounded by a white picket fence. The garden that circled the house was filled with red hedges and begonias in blue flower boxes. It was, as Hirsch recalled, an idyllic setting for his camp home. Every wish that my wife or children expressed was granted them. The children could live a free and untrammeled life. My wife's garden was a paradise of flowers. The children were particularly fond of the ones, prisoners, who worked on the garden. My whole family displayed an intense love of agriculture, and particularly for animals of all sorts. Every Sunday, I had to walk them all across the fields and visit the stables, and we might never miss out on the kennels where the dogs were kept. Our 2 horses and the foal were especially beloved. The children always kept animals in the garden, creatures the prisoners were forever bringing them. Tortoises, martens, cats, lizards. There was always something new and interesting to be seen there. In summer, they splashed in the paddling pool in the garden or in the Sola River. But their greatest joy was when Daddy bathed with them. He had, however, so little time for all these childish pleasures. It was this attempt to maintain a normal life in the midst of extraordinary cruelty and inhumanity that made Auschwitz a place out of Dante's Inferno. At times, Auschwitz resembled the theater of the absurd. There were even traffic regulations in the camp, and red and green traffic lights. Infractions brought an investigation by the SS Traffic Court, as Mengele himself discovered a month after his arrival, when he hit an SS armaments truck while speeding on his motorcycle toward Birkenau. Mengele was injured, and parts of his uniform as well as the motorcycle were damaged, but the court found that the SS Hauptsturmführer's guilt could not be established. There were many other Dantesque aspects to life at Auschwitz. The camp had its own soccer stadium, library, photographic club, theater, SS swimming pool, and symphony orchestra. There was even a brothel called the Puff, used by SS men and some favored prisoners. When Mengele entered the nightmare world of Auschwitz, he immediately set himself apart from the other SS doctors. He was the only camp doctor to have served on the Eastern Front and to have been awarded the Iron Cross and other decorations. Dr. Hans Munch, an SS doctor who served in a bacteriological laboratory in a subcamp of Auschwitz and who became a close friend of Mengele's, remembers that Mengele was enormously proud of his medals and wore them prominently displayed on his uniform. Mengele frequently referred to his combat experience, and he quickly developed a special aura in the camp because of his frontline fighting, which contrasted sharply with the desk careers of the other camp doctors. Mengele coupled his combat status with workaholic devotion to his duties. While other Auschwitz doctors did no more than was required of them, Mengele was always undertaking new projects and extra responsibility. He flourished in Auschwitz, so much so that even today some survivors still mistakenly refer to him as the chief physician of the camp, a post in fact held by Dr. Eduard Wirtz, who appointed Mengele senior doctor in the women's camp in Birkenau. Within days after his arrival, while Auschwitz was in the throes of one of its many typhoid epidemics, Mengele established a reputation for radical and ruthless efficiency. The nearby marshland made clean water difficult to obtain and posed a constant threat from mosquitoes. Other SS doctors had failed in their efforts to curb typhus in the close quarters of the camp barracks. Mengele's solution to the epidemic was set out in one of 78 indictments drawn up in 1981 by the West German Prosecutor's Office, when the authorities thought he was still alive. In terms of detailed evidence, this arrest warrant is the most damning and complete document that was ever compiled against him. According to the warrant, on May 25, 1943, Mengele sent 507 gypsies and 528 gypsy women suspected of typhus to the gas chamber. It also charged that on May 25th or 26th, he spared those gypsies who were German, while he sent approximately 600 others to be gassed. Such contempt for these lives is explained by Mengele's view that gypsies were a subspecies. The irony was that Mengele himself was sometimes known to remark on his own distinctly un-Aryan looks, which more closely resembled those of a gypsy than of a perfect Nordic specimen. Indeed, Mengele's own racial classification by the SS had put him in the Dinarisch-Ostisch category, which meant that his predominant features were of Eastern origin. Since childhood, he had been self-conscious about his slightly tawny skin, his penetrating brown-green eyes, and his dark brown hair. At school, he had endured mild taunts from his classmates about his gypsy looks. And in Bavaria, where Mengele grew up, the word for gypsy had a derogatory meaning denoting an unstable and unsettled person. His hometown of Gunzburg especially was full of folklore about gypsies coming to kidnap children who misbehaved. In late 1943, a severe outbreak of typhus struck the women's camp in Birkenau, which was then under Mengele's control. Out of some 20,000 half-starved women, about 7,000 were seriously ill. According to Dr. Ella Lingens, an Austrian doctor sent to Auschwitz for trying to help some Jewish friends escape from Vienna, Mengele proposed another of his radical solutions. He sent one entire Jewish block of 600 women to the gas chamber and cleared the block. He then had it disinfected from top to bottom. Then he put bathtubs between this block and the next, and the women from the next block came out to be disinfected and then transferred to the clean block. Here they were given a clean new nightshirt. The next block was cleaned in this way, and so on until all the blocks were disinfected. End of typhus. The awful thing was that he could not put those first 600 somewhere. Mengele's techniques for eradicating typhus were greatly admired by the garrison physician, Dr. Wirtz. In February 1944, Wirtz cited them as one of several reasons why Mengele should be awarded the Kriegsverdienstkreuz, or War Service Medal, noting that, in combating a severe typhoid epidemic, he was infected himself with a very heavy typhus. Mengele's anti-typhus measures were but samples of the cynical disregard for life that he so quickly developed at Auschwitz. Toward the end of 1944, there was a shortage of food. There was not enough even to sustain the meager 700-calorie-a-day diet for the 40,000 women of Sea Camp, Birkenau. Mengele was heard to tell SS colleagues that he could no longer feed the debilitated prisoners. He would therefore have them liquidated. During the following 10 nights, convoys of trucks carried the women, 4,000 a day, to the gas chamber. A horrible sight, this caravan of trucks, their headlights stabbing the darkness, each bearing a human cargo of 80 women who either filled the air with their screams or sat mute, paralyzed with fear. But it was at the railhead selections, when new arrivals stepped down from their squalid boxcars to meet their fate, that Mengele established his reputation, even among fellow SS doctors, as a ruthless cynic. According to an inmate doctor, Olga Lengyel, Mengele was by far and away the chief provider for the gas chamber and the crematory ovens. Two SS doctors were assigned duty at the railhead to examine each new transport. Their capricious powers of life and death, as the prisoners filed obediently past, were graphically described by Dr. Miklos Nisli, who became Mengele's pathologist. Any person who had entered the gates of the KZ was a candidate for death. He whose destiny had directed him into the left-hand column was transformed by the gas chamber into a corpse within an hour. Less fortunate was he whom adversity had singled out for the right-hand column. He was still a candidate for death, but with this difference, that for 3 months, or as long as he could endure, he had to submit to all the horrors that the KZ had to offer, till he dropped from utter exhaustion. Most SS doctors considered the selections the most stressful of all their camp duties. Dr. Ella Lingens said, "Some, like Werner Roeder, who hated his work, and Hans Kernisch, who was deeply disgusted by the job, had to get drunk before they appeared on the ramp." Only two doctors performed the selections without any stimulants of any kind, Dr. Josef Mengele and Dr. Fritz Klein. Dr. Mengele was particularly cold and cynical. Klein's impassive approach stemmed from the fact that he was a virulent anti-Semite. He had hated all Jews since one seduced his fiancée while they were undergraduates, and he was once overheard saying that he even liked the smell of the crematoria. In Mengele's view, the biggest threat to the superiority of the German race was posed by the Jews. "He once told me there are only two gifted people in the world, Germans and Jews, and it's a question of who will be superior," said Dr. Lingens. So he decided that they had to be destroyed. For tens of thousands of inmates, Mengele was one of the first people they saw at Auschwitz. Many have testified to his immaculate and well-manicured appearance as he exercised his power of life and death. Some women, whom he was not averse to humiliating by having them parade naked while he carried out his selections, found him a handsome man, though a gap between his upper two front teeth rather spoiled the effect. Survivors remarked on the impression made by his tight-fitting SS uniform with glistening black boots, white gloves, and polished cane, as he surveyed his prey with a sure eye, smiling sometimes and whistling an operatic air. "How we hated this charlatan," said Dr. Lengyel. "He profaned the very word science. How we despised his detached, haughty air, his continual whistling, his absurd orders, his frigid cruelty. Day after day he was at his post, watching the pitiful crowd of men and women and children go struggling past, all in the last stages of exhaustion from the inhuman journey in cattle trucks. He would point with his cane at each person and direct them with one word, right or left. He seemed to enjoy his grisly task." Mengele's sickbay selections were notorious too, perversely playing on the emotions of prison doctors and their attempts by whatever means possible to save their patients from the gas chamber. Dr. Lingens said, "The cynical Dr. Mengele made things easy for himself. He ordered us, the prison doctors, to write out meticulous lists of our patients, complete with diagnoses and prognoses. We were to state an approximate date by which the patient would be fit for release from the hospital and for resumption of work. It was difficult to refuse writing such a list, as we were told nothing of its purpose, although we guessed it only too well. If we put down that a patient had to remain in the hospital for over 3 or 4 weeks, she was condemned. If we put down a shorter term, the doctor would send for the patient and shout at us, 'What? You say you're a doctor, and you mean to send this half-dead, wretched creature out of the hospital in under 4 weeks?' This made it seem as if we were ruthlessly cheating the patients of their due time for recovery. Or, if Dr. Mengele accepted the short-term prognosis, he would insist on the release of the patient at the stated date. In the case of those enfeebled women, a release was sometimes nothing short of murder. It was often impossible to find a way out." Out of sight of Aryan colleagues like Dr. Lingens, who, unlike Jewish doctors, could risk challenging his excesses, Mengele resorted to a variety of cruel methods of execution. The West German indictment lists a monstrous catalogue. Josef Mengele is accused of having actively and decisively taken part in selections in the prisoners' sick blocks, of such prisoners who, through hunger, deprivation, exhaustion, sickness, disease, abuse, or other reasons, were unfit for work in the camp, and whose speedy recovery was not envisaged, and also of those who had contagious or singularly unsightly illnesses, such as a skin outbreak. Those selected were killed either through injections or firing squads, or by painful suffocation to death through prussic acid in the gas chambers, in order to make room in the camp for the fit prisoners, selected by him or other SS doctors in the aforementioned fashion. The injections that killed were made with phenol, petrol, avipal, chloroform, or air into the circulation, especially into the heart chamber, either with his own hands, or he ordered the SS sanitary worker to do it while he watched. He is alleged also to have supervised in cases of camp and hospital block selections, when SS sanitary workers threw granules of prussic acid formula, Zyklon B, into the inlet pipes of the rooms with people condemned to die hemmed together, or he threw it himself. In late August 1943, Mengele's wife, Irena, travelled from Freiburg in Germany, where she had chosen to spend the war, to visit him at Auschwitz. Typhus quarantine restrictions nearly kept her there longer than she had planned. "What's this stench?" Irena is reported to have asked her husband, looking skyward to the chimney and the smoke clouds beyond. "Don't ask me about this," Mengele is said to have casually replied. According to Mengele's son, Rolf, his mother later told him this was the moment when she began to have her doubts, when the marriage first faltered before it finally died 6 years later. "Because of the war, they never had a proper marriage," said Rolf. "My mother was happy, cheerful, full of life, an emotional person." Those of Mengele's SS colleagues who got to know him well remark that he never discussed his personal life. They do not remember him even mentioning the birth of his son in 1944. There were times, however, when Mengele's icy composure slipped, when he became agitated and excited. These occasions usually occurred when he was searching for twins from the rail transports that had just arrived. "Zwillinge! Zwillinge! Zwillinge! Twins! Twins! Twins!" was what he shouted, said Horst von Glasenapp, the West German judge who took scores of affidavits during the 1970s from surviving Mengele victims. One, Irena Slotkin, who was 5 when she went to Auschwitz, recalled, "I remember the first time I saw him. He was wearing green, dark green, and I remember his boots. That was probably the level of my eyes. Black, shiny boots. He was asking for Zwillinge, Zwillinge. He sounded angry. I don't know that I understood if it applied to me. We knew that whatever we had to do, we'd better do it fast and right." Her brother, René, remembered being saved by Mengele because he was a twin. "At one point toward the end of the war, I was scheduled to go to the chambers. I knew I was going to lose my life. We were being loaded onto trucks when this car comes up, a convertible. That's when I saw Mengele. We were taken off the truck. He stopped the whole procession because they were going to kill his twins." Another witness, Dr. Martina Pusina, whom Mengele employed as his anthropologist to measure the external features of twins, once saw him shrieking in a loud voice, "Twins out! Twins out!" while running alongside a procession of Hungarian Jews as they streamed off the train. There were women walking with the children, going away, and he was giving orders that they should stay behind and would be taken care of. At other times, Mengele would cynically adopt a more soothing tone, as this unnamed witness said in a deposition to the U.S. Army. "Several times we noticed the hypocritical manner in which the grim Dr. Mengele treated women and children alighting from the train. 'Madam, take care, your child will catch cold. Madam, you are ill and tired after a long journey. Give your child to this lady, and you will find it later in the children's nursery.' On these days he was in a good mood, treating in a friendly manner the people whom he sent to death, and who were very often reduced to smoke 5 or 6 hours after their arrival. But whatever his demeanour, it was Mengele above all others whom the survivors watching the selections most vividly recall. In the 1964 trial of 22 Auschwitz defendants, one witness, Aria Fuchs, said that while he worked near the arrival ramps, he constantly saw Mengele perform the selections. "But Mengele cannot have been there all of the time," asked the incredulous judge. "In my opinion, always," responded Fuchs, "night and day." More than 30 years after the end of the war, Mengele defended the camp selections in night-long arguments with his son during their meeting in Brazil. Rolf recalls his father's defense. "He told me he did not invent Auschwitz, and that he was not personally responsible for the incidents there. Auschwitz already existed. He wanted to help, but that was very limited. He couldn't help everyone. For instance, on the platforms, he asked me, what was he to do when the half-dead and infected people arrived?" It was beyond one's imagination to describe the circumstances there. He said his job was to clarify only able to work and unable to work. He tried to grade the people as able to work as often as possible. He thinks he saved the lives of several thousand people in that way. He didn't order the extermination, and he was not responsible. He said the twins owe their lives to him. He said he never harmed anybody personally, and he got very excited at this point. He asked me if I, his son, believed the lies in the newspapers. But Mengele's defense is not supported by dozens of sworn statements from inmates, as well as fellow doctors and SS men. Mengele did not grade people able to work for humanitarian reasons, but rather because he viewed Auschwitz as the ultimate human laboratory with a limitless supply of material to pursue his research, which the war had inconveniently interrupted. So obsessed was he with finding vast numbers of twins that he attended railhead selections even when it was not his turn. He could be seen bargaining with the SS doctors on duty to set the twins aside for him. Mengele's claim that he never harmed anyone is also contradicted by the voluminous evidence of his experiments with twins. Mengele's research gathered momentum in the spring of 1944, when the transports carrying Hungarian Jews began to arrive. The West German indictment against Mengele lists witnesses to at least 39 separate selections that he is alleged to have performed between April and August, involving tens of thousands of Jews. The actual figure is probably twice that, since on many occasions no witnesses would have survived. Although many of Mengele's experiments covered a range of studies, from bacteriology to bone marrow transplants, their principal purpose seems to have been to unlock the secret of creating multiple births with genetically engineered Aryan features. As the West German indictment noted, the research into twins occupied a large part of the pseudo-experiments of the accused, according to the court's preliminary investigations. This was especially interesting to the Nazi regime, in particular with regard to a desired increase in the birth rate through medically manipulated increase in the number of births of twins. But the challenge was not just how to improve the fertility of German women, though Mengele showed a passing interest in that with a series of weird sexual experiments. It was really about perfecting and preserving the best features of this mythical Aryan super-race, even down to blue eyes, blonde hair, strong and healthy bodies. Quality could not be sacrificed in pursuit of quantity. There could be no weakening of the Aryan strain. Various other experiments, notably sterilization, were already underway at Auschwitz when Mengele arrived. The purpose of these experiments was to unlock an efficient and easy means of mass sterilization for the recently conquered inferior races. In addition, Colonel Victor Brack, chief administrative officer at the Reich Chancellery, had suggested to Himmler that instead of liquidating Jews, it might be more productive to the war effort to put some of them to work, provided a fast and efficient method of birth control could be found. Dr. Horst Schumann and his staff had thus embarked on a series of experimental castrations by X-ray, which proved to be extremely painful for the victims. One surviving record shows that Schumann and his doctors performed 90 castrations in one day. Women, too, were subjected to massive doses of radiation, and their ovaries were then removed to establish the exact dosage required for sterilization. Mengele's ambition went far beyond finding a method of containing the reproductive capacity of the Jewish race. He was more concerned with guaranteeing the racial purity of future generations of Germans. A research program calculated to catch the imagination of the Nazi hierarchy in order to further his career. Mengele had already made it clear that he intended to pursue an academic career after the war, although Dr. Lingens had doubts about his ability.
"I would say he was moderately gifted," she said. "I saw two of his publications before the war, and there was certainly nothing brilliant about them. I thought he might make a professor in about 20 years.
Dr. Hans Munch, who worked at the Hygiene Institute of the Military SS at Reisko, an Auschwitz subcamp, and who came to know Mengele well, had no doubt about his motivation. "I saw him as a convinced National Socialist who never questioned how the final solution was administered in the camp. He was an opportunist. During that period, ideology had a great influence. Himmler was one of the great Nazi mystics, and it is conceivably possible that pseudo-scientific research was done with the purpose of pleasing Himmler. Certainly, Mengele's primary goal was to become a university professor after the war. The theory that Mengele's blind ambition drove him, that his research was so important to him that any inhumanity paled into insignificance, is reinforced by the findings of the West German indictment. The accused, Josef Mengele, is charged with having carried out medical experiments on living prisoners for scientific publication out of ambition and personal career progression. He fully intended the victim to die according to the manner of the experiment, and valued their lives very cheaply. They often died merely to further his medical knowledge and academic education. Funds for his genetics research at Auschwitz had been authorized by the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, the German Research Council, in August 1943. It seems that Professor von Verschuer, then director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Human Heredity and Genetics, actually secured the grant from the Council. In a progress report to the Council, von Verschuer wrote, "My co-researcher in this research is my assistant, the anthropologist and physician Mengele. He is serving as Hauptsturmführer and camp doctor in the concentration camp Auschwitz. With the permission of the Reichsführer SS, Himmler, anthropological research is being undertaken on the various racial groups in the concentration camp, and blood supplies will be sent to my laboratory for investigation. This money was used to construct a special pathology laboratory that Mengele had built into Crematorium 2 at Birkenau, where newly gassed victims could be dissected. It was fitted with the most modern equipment available, its red concrete floor dominated by a dissecting table of polished marble with several sinks, one of them plumbed with nickel taps. The pathologist he chose to perform this task was the Hungarian Jewish doctor Miklos Nisli, who arrived at Auschwitz on May 29, 1944. That day, Mengele went straight to the railhead and ordered all doctors to one side. A group of 50 gathered. Mengele asked those who had studied at German universities, had a thorough knowledge of pathology, and had practiced forensic medicine to step forward. "Be careful," he warned them. "You must be equal to the task." Dr. Nisli said, his menacing gesture left little to the imagination. I glanced at my companions. Perhaps they were intimidated. What did it matter? My mind was already made up. I broke ranks and presented myself. Dr. Mengele questioned me at length, asking where I had studied, the names of my pathology professors, how I had acquired a knowledge of forensic medicine, how long I had practiced, etc. Apparently my answers were satisfactory, for he immediately separated me from the others and ordered my colleagues to return to their places. For the moment, they were spared. Dr. Nisli's first task was to pass an examination in dissection. Several corpses were brought to him for examination in the presence of SS and prison doctors. I extracted all the organs, noted everything that was abnormal, and replied without hesitation to all the numerous questions they fired at me. Their faces showed that their curiosity had been satisfied, and from their approving nods and glances, I surmised that I had passed the examination. Mengele had already made a bizarre start in his attempt to perfect the ideal German specimen by seeing if he could change the pigmentation of eyes by injecting different colored dyes. 36 children from one barrack in Birkenau were used for the eye tests, which resulted in painful infections and sometimes blindness. After the tests, the children served no further use, and so they were gassed. The results of this research, which began in the summer of 1943 and was supplemented with funds from the German Research Council in September of that year, were witnessed by a Jewish inmate doctor, Wexler Janku. In June 1943, I went to the gypsy camp in Birkenau. I saw a wooden table. On it were samples of eyes. They each had a number and a letter. The eyes were very pale yellow to bright blue, green, and violet. Another witness, Vera Kriegel, said she saw a wall covered with eyes in one of Mengele's laboratories. "They were pinned up like butterflies," she said. "I thought I was dead and already living in hell." The eyes were dispatched to Professor von Verschuer's Institute in Berlin. Coming across a report on eye pigmentation being drafted by one institute researcher toward the end of the war, the co-editor of a medical publication noted that one set of guinea pigs, grandparents, parents, and children, had died at the same time. One could assume they had been killed in the concentration camp. In order to perfect a method of mass-producing suitable people to populate the new German territories and replace the depleted ranks of the army, Mengele set out to establish which attributes and disabilities were inherited genetically, as distinct from being acquired by lifestyle and environment. This is best achieved by the comparative study of twins, with one child in each pair used as a control. But such a comparison is valid only if a detailed life history is available. In Auschwitz, this was usually not possible. Mengele therefore used a system that was necessarily random and of dubious scientific worth. This raises a challenge to the assessment of some students of the Mengele phenomenon that, but for the corrupting influence of the times, he might have been a leader in the field of genetics and anthropology. Twins destined for Mengele's experiments were housed in Barrack 14 of Camp F in Birkenau, nicknamed the Zoo. There, on Mengele's orders, they were given good food, comfortable beds, and hygienic living conditions to build up their health for the most important part of the experimental process, the comparative study of their anatomy and bodily functions. The purpose of building up their strength was to prevent infections from interfering with the results of the study, other than those illnesses like typhus, which were deliberately induced in order to monitor their effects. Many of the children adored Mengele. Uncle Pepe, they called him. On some days, he brought them sweets, as Vera Alexander, a survivor, explained. "He brought chocolate for them, the most beautiful clothes, white pants, even aprons, and the girls had ribbons in their hair. One day he shouted at me because one girl had one ribbon lower than the other. He told me, 'How did you do it? They are not as I like them.'" Following this preliminary health-building phase, the twins were moved to the hospital in Camp B2F for the in vivo stage. This involved experiments performed while the children were alive. Camp records show that transfers of Jewish children, together with twin children, adult twins, dwarfs, and cripples from the transports to the hospital, began in July 1944. It is impossible to put a figure on the number of twins on whom Mengele experimented, although an idea of the scale was set out in the West German indictment. At times, it is alleged that 200 pairs of boy twins alone were held in readiness for the experiments of the accused Josef Mengele. In the first step of the in vivo stage, precise measurements were taken of their skulls, ears, noses, and other external features. For this process, Mengele employed the services of Dr. Martina Puzina, former assistant to the Polish anthropology professor Jan Czekanowski at the University of Lwów. Czekanowski had perfected a method of statistically measuring different external features in terms of racial groups. As a member of the Polish underground, Dr. Puzina was sent to Auschwitz, and she soon contracted typhus. As Dr. Puzina explained, it was while she was in hospital that Mengele discovered who she was and recruited her. Mengele walked past me, and I heard the Polish doctor tell him that I had been Professor Czekanowski's assistant before the war. He was very excited about this and told the doctor that I should report to him the following day. I was so weak that I had to be carried there. When I first saw him sitting there at his desk, he struck me as being very young and clean. He was always clean and smart. Mengele was sitting down with Dr. Kernisch. Mengele asked me what work I had been doing while in the camp, and I told him, carrying stones. For some reason he laughed and said, "Well, you'd better come and work for me." My impression was that he was completely indifferent to what was going on around him. Dr. Puzina was given her own bed in special hospital quarters, and her food ration was doubled to speed her recovery. After she had regained her strength, Mengele took her to an office he had assigned for her work. She was supplied with the latest Swiss precision measuring instruments and began work after the Hungarian Jews arrived, starting in April 1944. "We weren't supposed to see the twins' selections," she said, "but my office was quite near the railway track, and I remember seeing him walking up and down at selections, shouting. He looked quite mad sometimes." For the next 6 months, almost until Auschwitz was liberated by the Red Army in January 1945, Dr. Puzina measured 250 pairs of twins, carefully noting down every detail: the distance from the nose to the ear, the distance between the ears, the circumference of the head, and so on. From time to time, Mengele came to check her work. "He wasn't very talkative. He just used to look at the charts that had been written up," she said. "He never told me what he was applying this work to, but I had an idea. He wanted every detail, especially any difference in twins and their eyes." After the measurements, the twins were taken to the men's hospital, Block 15 in Camp B2F. There, Mengele had the children strip, and he examined them for hours in the minutest detail. No part of their anatomy escaped his attention. When this examination was over, the real torture began. Crude surgery and other painful tests were performed, often without anesthetics. There were needless amputations, lumbar punctures, typhus injections, and wounds deliberately infected to compare how each twin reacted. In the view of the West German indictment, all were devoid of any recognizable knowledge being gained from them. Scores of Mengele's guinea pigs died at this stage, many of them from a particularly bizarre experiment in which the blood supplies of different pairs of twins were interchanged. The results of one of these experiments were graphically described by a witness, Vera Alexander. "One day, Mengele brought chocolate and special clothes. The next day, SS men came and took two children away. They were two of my pets, Tito and Nino. One of them was a hunchback. 2 or 3 days later, an SS man brought them back in a terrible state. They had been cut. The hunchback was sewn to the other child, back to back, their wrists back to back too. There was a terrible smell of gangrene. The cuts were dirty, and the children cried every night." One survivor, subjected to this kind of experiment with her sister and a group of several other female twins, recalled, "Each woman was given a blood transfusion from another set of twins, so that Mengele could observe the reaction. We two each received 350 cc of blood from a pair of male twins, which brought on a reaction of severe headache and high fever." Mengele also forced the two sisters to have sex with other twins, apparently to discover if twins would reproduce twins. For this reason, he wouldn't release us to work and tried to find suitable partners for us. When we objected that such an experiment was impermissible, he told us that we were prisoners and that we had no say in the matter. Irena Slotkin and her twin brother, René, survived this in vivo stage of Mengele's work. She said that,
"Somewhere in my head, I had a good impression. You know, a doctor is a doctor, and so he's not going to hurt me. But of course, he did."
These in vivo tests furnished Mengele only with superficial and incomplete information. In his passion to learn everything about the similarities and differences in twins, it was the next and final stage of his experiments that was the most important: the dissection of their bodies, so that their organs and general development could be compared. For this simultaneous evaluation of anomalies, Mengele's twins, his most treasured specimens, whom he had cosseted and fed, had to die at the same time. Dr. Miklos Nisli, who performed the dissections for Mengele, elaborated, "Where, under normal circumstances, can one find twins who die at the same place and at the same time? For twins, like everyone else, are separated by life's varying circumstances. One may die at 10, the other at 50. In the Auschwitz camp, however, there were several hundred sets of twins, and therefore as many possibilities of dissection." An explanation for Mengele's behavior, demonstrating sincere affection for small children whom he planned to kill and dissect, has been advanced by Professor Yehuda Bauer of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. "People who make experiments on mice or apes or rats can do it because they do not identify with the objects of their experiments. If you make experiments on white rats, you know, white rats can be quite nice. So some of these doctors establish a relationship. This is a nice animal. I have to kill it, but while it is still alive, we have some kind of relationship. That is the kind of relationship that is established between the murderers and their victims." Among the first child guinea pigs that Mengele delivered to Dr. Nisli, who was waiting to perform the autopsy at his newly built laboratory, was a pair of two-year-old twins. "I opened the file and glanced through it. Very detailed clinical examinations, accompanied by x-rays, descriptions, and artist's drawings, indicated from the scientific viewpoint the different aspects of these two little beings' twinhood. Only the pathology report was missing. It was my job to supply it. The twins had died at the same time, and were now lying beside each other on the big dissection table. It was they who had to, or whose tiny bodies had to, resolve the secret of the reproduction of the race." Among the 40 pages of the West German indictment are 9 separate allegations involving the deaths of 153 children, whom Mengele is alleged to have killed in order to undertake dissections. One charge alleges that Mengele had 100 children shot in the back of the head for his autopsies. He is also said to have lured some of the more unwilling children to the crematorium from the experimental block by offering them sweets and then shooting them on the way. One of his most common methods of ensuring simultaneous death was to inject chloroform into their hearts, coagulating the blood and causing heart failure. According to an affidavit by Dr. Nisli, Mengele once killed 14 gypsy twins himself in this way. "In the workroom, next to the dissecting room, 14 gypsy twins were waiting and crying bitterly. Dr. Mengele didn't say a single word to us and prepared a 10cc and 5cc syringe. From a box, he took Avipal, and from another box he took chloroform, which was in 20cc glass containers, and put these on the operating table. After that, the first twin was brought in, a 14-year-old girl.
Dr. Mengele ordered me to undress the girl and put her head on the dissecting table. Then he injected the Avipal into her right arm, intravenously. After the child had fallen asleep, he felt for the left ventricle of the heart and injected 10 cc of chloroform. After one little twitch, the child was dead, whereupon Dr. Mengele had her taken into the corpse chamber. In this manner, all 14 twins were killed during the night. This method was first noticed by Dr. Neasley on a set of 4 pairs of twins, all under 10 years old, who had attracted Mengele's attention because 3 of the pairs each had different colored eyes. The eyes and other organs were removed and dispatched to Professor von Verschuer's Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, marked "War Materials, Urgent." Dr. Neasley, knowing the children had been murdered by chloroform injection, left the "cause of death" section of his dissection report blank. Since medical experiments carried a high security classification, the facade that all Mengele's guinea pigs had died of natural causes had to be maintained, and he ordered Dr. Neasley to fill it in. The choice of causes was left to my own judgment and discretion. The only stipulation was that each cause be different. One of Mengele's common techniques was to infect twins, to compare how the illness affected them, first while they were alive, then, for more probing results, after they were dead. An inmate doctor, Johann Chespiva, said, "During my work at the gypsy camp, I came across Mengele and watched his activities. I personally observed him infecting gypsy twins with typhus in order to observe whether the twins reacted differently or in the same way. Shortly after they had been infected, they were gassed." This comparative technique became commonplace. If one twin died of natural causes, the other twin was killed for comparison. If the slightest difference in ability was discerned, otherwise healthy twins were likely to be permanently disabled by Mengele's curiosity. On one occasion, the Reichenbergs, 2 brothers who greatly resembled each other, were mistakenly selected as twins by one of Mengele's colleagues. They did not object when they were placed in the right-hand column at the ramp, unaware that Mengele and the experimental block awaited them. Ephraim Reichenberg said that his brother had a beautiful voice and sang once for the Germans, but his own voice was very poor, and Mengele wanted to know why one twin had a melodious voice while the other did not. He conducted crude surgery on the vocal cords of both children that impaired their speech. Eventually, Ephraim lost all use of his vocal cords. Not until late 1984 did his speech return, after a special microphone was installed in his neck just below his jaw, making his voice sound as though it came from a computer. "Until I bought this wonderful device, I couldn't speak at all," he said. "This, too, was invented by the Germans, and that is a pity." Mengele displayed an extraordinary fascination for anything connected with race. After spotting a hunchbacked father standing next to his 15-year-old son, who had a deformed right foot, he was impatient to learn if there were further common abnormalities. He selected them from the ramp and gave them a last meal, which they ate ravenously, unaware that they were soon to die. Dr. Neasley was ordered to examine them with exact clinical methods before they died, and then to perform the dissections. Neasley felt himself suddenly spinning close to the edge of madness. 30 minutes later, Mengele had them shot and ordered their skeletons to be prepared by boiling their bodies in water so the flesh could be easily stripped from the bones. The skeletons were then immersed in a bath of petrol to make them dry, odorless, and white. Dr. Neasley said, "Dr. Mengele was highly pleased. He had brought several fellow officers with him. They pompously examined parts of the skeletons and launched into high-sounding scientific terms, talking as if the 2 victims represented an extremely rare medical phenomenon." they abandoned themselves completely to their pseudo-science. The skeletons were wrapped in strong paper and again forwarded to Professor von Verschuer's Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin. After the war, von Verschuer claimed that he was unaware of Mengele's activities, and at one stage even denied that Mengele had been his assistant. Just how much he did know about Mengele's experiments will probably never be proved, since he destroyed all his correspondence with Mengele. What is certain is that Mengele visited von Verschuer in Berlin at least once while he was at Auschwitz, and it seems inconceivable that the two men did not discuss the nature and the results of his experiments. According to von Verschuer's wife, Mengele confided at a dinner party on one of his Berlin visits that he found great difficulty in carrying out his work at Auschwitz. "It's horrific," she claims, he said. "I can't talk about it." Von Verschuer's daughter recalls that her father thought Mengele was clinically depressed and possibly suicidal. Depressed he may have been, but his enthusiasm for his work never flagged. Many inmate doctors recall Mengele as a man who had as much compassion and feeling for the prisoners at Auschwitz as a research scientist has for laboratory rats. "This was where he spent all his spare time," said Dr. Niesley about Mengele's custom-built dissection laboratory. "Here, in this man-made hell. Here, within these blood-stained walls, Dr. Mengele sat hunched for hours at a time, poring over his microscope." To Mengele's colleagues, he came across as a friendly but obsessive man. Dr. Hans Munch got to know him after Mengele sought his advice on how best to preserve specimens for dispatch to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. Dr. Munch was the only Auschwitz doctor acquitted by the Supreme National Tribunal in Krakow in December 1947 at a trial of SS men, and claims that he knew nothing of the details of Mengele's experiments. In his view, it was the combination of the madness of Auschwitz and Mengele's driving ambition for academic recognition that explained his behavior. In comparison to other doctors in the camp, he stood out. He did not fit the normal pattern of SS men and colleagues who, he thought, drank too much. In my view, he was a gifted scientist, but a combination of scientific knowledge, opportunism and ambition, which Mengele had, can lead to anything. Obsessive, Mengele certainly was. His appetite for experiments was insatiable. He had a habit of suddenly appearing at a barracks if he was short of human material. Olga Lengyel, an inmate doctor, said he called at any hour, day or night. During the inspection, all the exits in the barracks were closed. He arrived when we least expected him. Sometimes he'd come in whistling operatic airs. Ava Kaur, a twin, remembered the sheer terror that gripped the barracks after morning roll call. "It wasn't because his face was terrifying. His face could look very pleasant, but the atmosphere in the barracks before he came, and all the preparation by the supervisors, was creating that atmosphere of terror and horror that Mengele was coming. So everybody had to stand still. He would, for example, notice on one of the bunk beds that a twin was dead. He would yell and scream, 'What happened? How is it possible that this twin died?' But of course, I understand it today. An experiment had been spoiled." There are those like Dr. Munch, who, based on their knowledge of the man as a scientist, believe that, although Mengele had no thought for the suffering of his victims or justification for his experiments, there might have been valid short-term results that might be observed. Whatever the merits of this argument in purely scientific terms, Mengele's main aim, as interpreted by Dr. Puzina, the inmate anthropologist, was wholly unscientific. "I found Mengele a picture of what can only be described as a maniac. He turned the truth on its head. He believed you could create a new super race as though you were breeding horses. He thought it was possible to gain absolute control over a whole race. Man is so infinitely complex that the kind of strict control over such a vast population could never exist. He was a racist and a Nazi. He was ambitious up to the point of being completely inhuman. He was mad about genetic engineering. I believe he thought that when he'd finished with the Jewish race, he'd start on the Poles, and when he finished with them, he'd start on someone else. Above all, I believe that he was doing this for himself, for his career. In the end, I believed that he would have killed his own mother if it would have helped him. Apart from twins, Mengele engaged in a wide variety of other experiments. Ernest Michel worked as an orderly in the Auschwitz infirmary and recalled taking 8 women into an experimental room. I saw Mengele standing there in his uniform, surrounded by 3 or 4 others. There was electrical machinery, the likes of which I had never seen. As we brought in each girl, an officer would strap her down. We left quickly, because we didn't want to be around Mengele very long. After a while, the screaming inside stopped. When we took them out, 2 of the 8 were dead, 5 were in a coma, 1 was strapped to the cot. Mengele was standing there, discussing it very casually. The only word I could hear was experiment. According to the West German indictment, the purpose of these electrical experiments, conducted both in Birkenau and in the slave labor camp at Monowitz, was to test the patient's endurance. A considerable number of prisoners from Birkenau died in these experiments. From a total of 70 to 80 prisoners on whom the accused carried out such experiments in the spring of 1944, 20 to 30 prisoners are said to have died as a result in Monowitz. The indictment said Mengele had a permanent supply in the summer of 1944 of about 50 young women held in preparation for him in the prisoners' sick block of the women's camp in Birkenau. Many of them died from blood transfusions and extractions. He is alleged to have subjected a group of Polish nuns to extreme X-rays for research purposes, from which they suffered severe burns. He is alleged to have conducted bone marrow transplants, with the result that one victim had to have her right leg amputated from the knee because it got infected. She was spared from the gas chamber only due to the proximity of the Red Army and impending evacuation of the camp. He is alleged to have operated on the sex organs of male prisoners, supposedly to castrate or sterilize them. He is said to have had a number of women prisoners taken to the Black Wall between blocks 10 and 11 of the main camp and shot. Their breasts were cut off, and the muscles from the thigh were kept as cultivating material for experiments in Mengele's hygienic laboratory. He is said to have forced a mother, Ruth Elias, to cover her breasts with tape to see how long the baby could live without food. As the child grew weaker, she mercy killed it after a compassionate nurse gave her some morphine and a syringe. He is said to have stood on pregnant women's stomachs until the fetuses were expelled. He is even said to have dissected a 1-year-old while the child was still alive. At such times, it might seem that Mengele was motivated by sheer sadism, although most witnesses have remarked not at his pleasure at watching or inflicting suffering, but at his total detachment from it. Etched in Dr. Puzina's memory is a moment when she saw Mengele transfixed by music which an orchestra was playing while a work gang filed past, carrying the day's dead. She said, "Every day people died at work because they were so weak." Mengele was standing there, saying nothing, his head in his hand, eyes down, just listening. He was completely rooted to the spot, utterly oblivious of this march of the dead right next to him. There were bodies, and there was Mengele, just enraptured by the music. I remember it happened in the hospital, too. The orchestra A very fine orchestra, Hungarian Jews, just turned up to play. And there were people terribly ill all round us, just skeletons. Mengele didn't even look at them.
Dr. Tobias Brücher, a Menninger Foundation psychoanalyst who practiced near Mengele's hometown of Günzburg and has studied his behavior, said it exhibited the narcissistic component of sadism, but not sadism itself. He didn't take pleasure in inflicting pain, but in the power he exerted by being the man who had to decide between life and death within the ideology of a concentration camp doctor. Mengele had the narcissistic pattern of the professional. In the subculture of medicine as a whole, there is a split between what you have to do and any emotion you might have, between doctors who take a strictly scientific approach and the medical doctor who cares for patients. In Germany, this split was evident in the euthanasia program for mental patients, which preceded the concentration camps. Doctors in the euthanasia program rationalized that the persons they condemned to death were better off now, or that they would die anyway. Mengele's personal acts of cruelty